The forest was still when the operation moved in. Cold air hung low over the South River site. Lights cut across tents and tarps. Officers stepped through brush with rifles ready. They had orders to clear the encampment. No one moved fast. No one wanted to be the first to face trouble. The command channel stayed tight as teams pushed deeper. A tent ahead stood closed. They called out. No answer. Another call. Then shots tore through the quiet. Voices broke. Officers shouted for cover. Someone was hit. Medics rushed forward. The ground shifted from tense to chaotic in seconds. When it stopped, one person lay dying, and several officers said they had been fired on. That claim met challenge within hours. By nightfall, the case carried more confusion than facts. The question hung over everything. What really happened inside that tent? Chapter 1, The Clearing Operation. The operation started before sunrise. The command post sat on a patch of cleared ground near the trail entrance. Lights from parked vehicles cast long shadows across the forest floor. Officers from several agencies gathered in small clusters, checking radios and adjusting gear. The briefing had run short. They were told the encampment needed to be cleared for safety concerns tied to the construction project in the area. They were warned about reports of armed resistance. Nothing about the day felt routine. Teams moved out in staggered lines. The forest was dense and dark. Damp soil muted their steps. The lead group advanced toward the deeper section where tents had been spotted during earlier reconnaissance. They worked slow. Every few yards, someone paused to scan. Their radios carried low voices from the command channel. The plan was simple. Approach the structures, call out, and secure anyone inside without force unless force met them first. That was the stated rule. As they neared the encampment, they saw tarps stretched between trees. Some tents were partly collapsed, others stood intact. The cold morning air made each breath visible. Officers signaled to form a partial arc around the first cluster. A call went out. Anyone inside was asked to step out. No one responded. They moved to the next tent. The same silence met them. A few officers exchanged glances. The forest carried no movement beyond their own. They pushed deeper. The next tent lay several yards off the main line, set behind a thick stand of brush. Someone pointed out faint light coming through the fabric wall. They approached from two sides. A voice with a steady tone delivered the command to exit. Again, there was no answer. Officers paused. A second command followed. Same result. One officer said he heard rustling from inside. Another raised his rifle but kept it lowered at the barrel. The tension built in the quiet. The third call came louder. Step out, hands visible. No reply. According to officer statements later collected, the moment that followed shifted fast. A sudden sharp sound broke through the area. Some officers believed it was a gunshot. Others described it as a loud crack. The reaction was immediate. Officers dropped to a crouch. More bursts followed. Debris kicked up from the ground. The forest lit up with muzzle flashes. Voices collided on the radio. Shots fired. Shots fired. Multiple officers yelling for cover. One officer fell back against a tree and called out that he had been hit. Another dragged him behind a mound of dirt while still returning fire. The air filled with smoke and broken light. The tent shook as rounds struck near it. Officers on the flank shouted for everyone to hold position. They tried to locate the source of the gunfire. Statements later taken said they believed it came from inside the tent. The sound bounced between trees, making direction hard to confirm in real time. The exchange lasted only seconds but felt longer. When it stopped, the forest settled again. Officers continued to cover the tent, unsure if more shots would come. Someone called for medics to move in as soon as the area was declared safe. Another officer repeated the earlier commands, telling anyone inside to come out with hands up. No one responded. A shield team advanced. Their steps were measured. They reached the tent entrance and pulled the flap open. What they found brought a sharp halt to the movement. A person lay inside on the ground. Later identification confirmed it was Manuel Esteban Paez Terán. The individual showed severe injuries. A handgun was reported near the body by officers on scene. The medics were cleared to move in. The medics entered fast. They checked for signs of life. Efforts were made to stabilize the individual. The officers stepped back and secured a perimeter. Radio traffic told command that one person inside the tent had been struck multiple times. The injured officer was placed on a stretcher and carried out toward the trail. Another officer applied pressure to his wound. The noise level dropped as the teams shifted from confrontation to emergency care. The forest around them seemed to close in. Every movement felt heavier now. A supervisor instructed everyone to maintain positions until investigators arrived. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation had been notified. They were expected to handle the scene. Officers waited with weapons lowered but ready. No one spoke much. Some officers stared at the tent. Others kept their eyes fixed on the perimeter. When the medics signaled they were finished, they stepped back from the tent. Their faces held the strain of the effort. The individual did not survive. The call was made to confirm the death. Radios carried the update to command. It spread through the teams. A mix of silence and tension filled the area. Officers who had engaged in the exchange stood off to the side while a supervisor began taking early notes. They were told not to discuss details among themselves. The agency vehicles arrived minutes later. GBI personnel stepped out and walked through the perimeter with calm, deliberate movements. They marked entry points, photographed the tent, and measured distances between impact spots in the dirt. They asked officers to line up for initial identification and separation protocols. The forest held the smell of gunfire. The sun pushed a weak light through the trees. GBI agents moved to secure all items found. They logged the handgun near Tehran. They flagged shell casings scattered around the clearing. They placed markers near trees struck by rounds. Officers were moved farther back to keep the area clear. Statements would come later. Right now, the focus was on preserving evidence. One GBI agent spoke with the supervisor about the sequence leading up to the gunfire. The supervisor repeated what officers had told him. Commands were issued. No response came. Shots erupted from the direction of the tent. Officers returned fire. Medical aid followed once the firing stopped. That was the early account. It was presented as what the officers believed happened in the moment. The forest kept its heavy quiet as the investigators worked. They opened the tent wide and inspected the interior. They noted positions, angles, and visible damage. Photographs were taken from every side. The work was steady and methodical. Nothing about the scene gave clear answers yet. The operation, which had started as a planned clearing, now carried a death and a wounded officer. The weight of that change settled over everyone present. Some officers stepped behind trees to gather themselves. Others fixed their eyes on the investigators. The scene felt suspended. The first chapter of the case closed when the body was removed and the evidence collection reached a stopping point. Even then, nothing felt resolved. The radio traffic had gone quiet, except for brief commands. Officers waited to be released from the scene. They had carried out the operation as ordered. Now the investigation would determine what had occurred inside the seconds that changed everything. Chapter 2, Conflicting Evidence. The morning after the shooting, investigators shifted from the forest to the lab and interview rooms. The urgency was clear. A death in a police operation needed answers, and those answers had to come from evidence, not assumptions. The GBI lab began examining every item pulled from the scene. The tent, the handgun recovered near Tehran, the shell casings, the clothing, and the soil samples all waited on stainless steel tables under bright lights. Each piece carried potential clarity. Each piece also carried risk. If the evidence conflicted with statements already made, the case would move toward national scrutiny. Tehran's background entered the investigation in a formal way now. Reports described Tehran as an environmental activist embedded in the South River Forest encampment. The profile gathered by investigators emphasized community ties, involvement in protest structures, and long-term presence in the wooded area. It was standard for a forensic inquiry to gather such details. They needed to understand the environment, daily patterns, and possible reasons Tehran might have stayed in that tent on that morning. Nothing in the profile could explain the gunfire. It only offered context. GBI reported early that a handgun had been found inside the tent. Officers had described it during their on-scene statements. The lab logged the weapon, checked the serial number, and began standard processing. They tested the gun for operational condition. They examined the slide, barrel, and chamber. They collected fingerprints where possible. They swabbed for DNA. The weapon showed signs of recent use based on residue found around the barrel. That finding supported the officer's account that shots had come from inside. It did not answer the central question. It only showed that the firearm had been fired at some point. Residue tests on clothing followed. Lab staff worked slow as they examined Tehran's sleeves and hands. They swabbed for gunshot residue and documented each location. The sample collection would take hours. These results would become a point of tension later because they would be measured against officer claims. At this stage, nothing was released. The internal report only noted that samples had been collected and sent for chemical analysis. Trajectory analysis began in another section of the lab. Investigators inspected the tent fabric with lights angled low to catch bullet paths. They marked small tears. They compared entry holes to exit holes. They noted scorch patterns. They created diagrams showing possible firing directions. Officers had said gunfire originated from inside the tent. The tent damage had to support or contradict that. Some holes appeared consistent with rounds fired from outside toward the tent. Others were harder to classify without knowing exact positions of officers when they returned fire. Meanwhile, in the interview rooms, officers involved in the clearing operation sat for recorded sessions. Each officer gave a timeline. They described approaching the tent, issuing commands, hearing no response, and then hearing what they believed was gunfire from inside. They described fear, confusion, and rapid reaction. Many officers noted low visibility due to tree cover and the angle of the tent relative to the clearing. Their statements remained consistent on the point that they believed they were under fire. This belief shaped their actions. Investigators had to separate perception from proven fact. Another set of interviews involved officers stationed farther back in the operation. These officers had heard the gunfire but did not have a direct line of sight. Their accounts varied slightly. Some described hearing one sharp shot before a burst followed. Others described multiple rapid shots with no clear pattern. These details mattered because they revealed how chaotic the sound environment had been. A single shot can echo differently depending on the angle. This created room for confusion. Outside the lab and interview rooms, pressure began building fast. Activists released public statements questioning the officer account. They argued that Tehran had been known as peaceful. They stated that witnesses from the encampment did not believe Tehran carried or fired a gun. Investigators noted these claims as allegations. They could not treat them as facts without evidence. Still, they documented them because the dispute formed part of the investigative landscape. Independent observers also began raising concerns. They pointed to inconsistencies between early officer claims and the limited information released by GBI. They requested transparency in lab results. They demanded review by a body outside the state. None of these claims altered the forensic process. They did alter the stakes. The case was no longer a local matter. It carried national weight. Back inside the lab, residue test reports returned. Analysts reviewed each page. They compared positive markers with expected patterns. They noted which samples produced strong reactions and which did not. Investigators reviewed the report and measured it against officer statements. The results supported the presence of residue on some surfaces. Interpretation required care. Residue transfer could occur in multiple ways. Investigators documented all possibilities before drawing a conclusion. Trajectory results came next. The diagrams showed multiple bullet paths traveling into the tent. Fewer paths suggested shots exiting. This raised questions about the sequence. Officers had reported incoming fire. The diagrams did not yet confirm or disprove that. They only showed complexity. Some angles matched what officers described. Others did not. Investigators prepared additional field tests to check whether sound bounce or visual obstruction might have misled officers during the first seconds. Activist interviews began in a separate facility. These interviews were calmer, but no less important. Some activists said they heard only one set of shots and believed they came from police. Others said the sound pattern was too fast to determine direction. A few reported that Tehran avoided confrontation. Again, these were allegations. They could not override forensic findings. Still, investigators logged each statement and tracked consistency across witnesses. GBI released a short public update stating that evidence was still being processed and that early findings indicated officers were fired upon. This statement drew immediate pushback. Activist groups argued that the investigation lacked independence. National media ran segments highlighting the dispute. The case gained traction, and pressure mounted for clarity. Reporters contacted the families of officers in Tehran. Families asked investigators for updates, but were told the inquiry was ongoing. Some relatives expressed anger. Others expressed fear. The uncertainty weighed on them. Investigators noted these reactions, but did not use them in the forensic record. As the dispute widened, the lab continued to compile data. They created a full evidence chart showing location, type, and analysis status. This chart became a core document for the investigative team. It showed that the case contained conflicting signals. It showed that a clear narrative would require combining physical evidence with verified timelines. It also showed that some questions might not be answered fully. Interviews with officers concluded with requests for diagrams. Officers drew placement maps. They indicated where they stood, where they moved, and where they believed the gunfire came from. These maps would play a role later when compared with tent damage. They also revealed how sight lines differed from one officer to another. That difference explained some conflicting statements. As investigators reviewed all this material, the pressure rose. They saw two narratives forming. One narrative said officers faced incoming fire and acted in defense. The other said Tehran never fired and the operation escalated too fast. The forensic record had not resolved the split. It had only deepened it. Public demonstrations intensified. People marched in the city center. They carried signs calling for truth. Police presence increased at these events. Some activists spoke to reporters, saying they believed the official account was flawed. Investigators noted that these statements, while forceful, could not determine the outcome of a forensic analysis. Inside the command office, investigators drafted a working summary. It listed areas of agreement and areas of dispute. Agreement included the presence of a firearm, the number of officers involved, and the timing of the operation. Dispute included who fired first and whether the firing sequence matched officer accounts. The working summary showed how far the investigation had come and how far it still needed to go. As the day closed, a senior investigator explained the situation to his team. Facts would decide the case. They would not answer pressure. They would not bend to public emotion. They would continue processing evidence until all possible clarity was reached. Even then, the final picture might hold gaps. The conflict between the two narratives did not ease. It tightened. Each new detail drew more attention. Each lab report carried weight. The investigation pressed forward. Chapter 3, Findings, Fallout, Aftermath. The findings arrived in stages. Investigators gathered in a conference room, lined with charts, photographs, and evidence maps from the forest scene. The GBI case lead walked through each item with a steady voice. The atmosphere carried weight. Everyone understood the scrutiny that would follow. The inquiry had been slow, technical, and tense. Now the pieces needed to be arranged into a final picture. Not a perfect picture, just one that reflected what could be proven. Lab summaries came first. The handgun recovered from the tent had been tested for ballistic consistency. Investigators confirmed that the weapon was operable. They confirmed that rounds found at the scene matched the caliber of the gun. They noted that residue existed on the barrel and slide. These were factual findings. What they did not confirm was the sequence in which the weapon had been fired, or the exact moment any shot left the barrel. That gap mattered. It set limits on what the investigators could claim. Clothing analysis followed. The residue tests on Tehran's hands and sleeves produced mixed results. Some samples showed trace levels, others did not. Analysts explained how residue could be transferred from close exposure to gunfire without indicating trigger contact. They explained how environmental contamination could produce background signals. These explanations did not settle the dispute. They only established that residue findings alone could not answer the central question. Trajectory analysis came next. Investigators reviewed the diagrams showing bullet paths into and through the tent. Most rounds were consistent with officer fire. A small number of holes could not be conclusively matched to outgoing fire. Analysts stated that these uncertainties were common in chaotic scenes. Angles shifted, surfaces folded, objects inside the tent could alter paths. These findings reinforced the complexity of the case. They did not resolve the claim of incoming shots. The case lead then addressed the timeline. Officers described a sudden crack, followed by bursts. Witnesses outside the encampment described rapid fire with no break. The acoustic environment had created conditions for confusion. Investigators acknowledged these discrepancies. They did not label them as misconduct or deception. They said perception under threat could distort sequence and direction. That statement reflected standard investigative caution. After reviewing the lab summaries, investigators turned to interviews. Officer statements remained consistent about their belief that they were fired upon. They described fear and low visibility. They described acting to protect themselves and each other. Investigators noted that these beliefs, accurate or not, shaped their decisions. At no point did investigators claim that officers coordinated false statements. They also did not confirm the accuracy of the officers' perception. They presented the statements as accounts given under stress. Activist statements were then summarized. These statements challenged the officer version. Some activists said they believed police fired first. Others noted Taran's reputation for avoiding conflict. None of these statements were treated as established fact. They were logged as allegations, documented for completeness, but not used as forensic proof. Investigators emphasized that eyewitness recall in high-stress events could be unreliable across all sides. With all evidence presented, the prosecutor's office delivered its determination. After reviewing the findings, they stated that the evidence did not support criminal charges against the officers. They based this on the officers' stated belief that they faced incoming fire, the presence of a firearm inside the tent, and the absence of conclusive proof to contradict the claim of self-defense. They framed the decision around what could be proven, not what was alleged. The ruling landed with force. Public reaction was immediate. Civil rights groups condemned the decision. Activist organizations called it a failure of accountability. Demonstrations formed in the city within hours. People marched through downtown streets, raising signs and chanting demands for independent review. The protests were organized and sustained. Police formed controlled lines to manage them. Tension rose but held short of major clashes. Family members released statements saying they believed the findings left critical questions unanswered. They asked for a federal review. They asked for transparency in the underlying data. Their requests echoed across local and national media. Commentators debated the credibility of the investigation. Some argued that the evidence supported the official version. Others argued that the unresolved gaps demanded further scrutiny. Political pressure followed. City officials faced questions about the future of the Cop City training facility. Some officials defended the project. Others distanced themselves, citing concerns about public trust. The controversy reached state lawmakers. Some called for legislative oversight on police operations involving protest encampments. Others stated that the investigation had been fair and complete. The split deepened the case's reach. Investigators returned to their files as criticism grew. They reviewed the findings again. They confirmed that every test had been documented. They confirmed that every interview had been preserved. They accepted that the public might not find closure in the final report. They understood that some cases, even with extensive forensic work, left questions that evidence could not answer. They prepared the final documentation for release. When the investigative file went public, summaries laid out the facts. The firearm was recovered. It had been fired at some point. The officers believed they faced gunfire. The residue findings were inconclusive. The tent damage was complex. The timeline carried gaps. No single piece of evidence resolved the dispute fully. The final report said the investigation reached its limit. It did not assign certainty to either narrative. Public forums met the release with anger and frustration. Activists held vigils for Taran, calling the outcome a reminder of systemic power imbalance. Supporters of the officers argued that the case proved how dangerous the clearing operations had become. The two narratives remained fixed in opposition. Each side anchored its view in the gaps the investigation left behind. As weeks passed, national outlets produced documentaries and long-form articles about the shooting. Some focused on policing policy, others focused on environmental activism and land defense movements. The broader story grew. It became part of a larger conversation about state power, protest rights, and use of force. Each piece of coverage carried the same unanswered question. What happened in the first few seconds outside that tent? In private meetings, state officials debated policy changes. They discussed adjusting protocols for clearing operations. They considered oversight measures for use of force incidents involving protest sites. No decisions came immediately. The discussions showed how the case had pushed the system to examine itself. Whether any change would follow was still unclear. On the ground near the South River Forest, activists built memorials at the site. Flowers, signs, and candles marked the area. Officers occasionally patrolled the perimeter to keep the site accessible. Tension between these two roles continued to shape the atmosphere. People walked quietly along the forest edge, stopping near the memorial and reading names and messages left behind. Investigators closed the active file. They archived the evidence. They documented the unresolved points. They acknowledged the limits of forensic reconstruction in chaotic environments. The file stated that the inquiry answered what could be answered and admitted what it could not determine. That final line became the center of debate. Some saw it as honesty, others saw it as failure. The long-term effect of the case reached beyond the forest. Activist groups used it to mobilize more support. Police agencies used it to revise training materials. Lawmakers used it to frame arguments for or against the training complex. The case became part of a broader struggle over public space, force, and responsibility. Months later, the controversy had not faded. It became a reference point in discussions about policing and protest. It became a symbol for some and a caution for others. What remained unchanged was the space between the two narratives. That space defined the aftermath.